Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Nina Sun, and I am an associate editor for the SRHM Journal. Today's episode is a special one. The conversation you're about to hear is the recording from an event that SRHM hosted in response to the recent changes in abortion laws in Texas. During this event, expert speakers discussed the Texas abortion ban, the strategies being pursued to stop its enforcement, and the ban's implications for sexual and reproductive health and rights in the U.S. and beyond. We hope you enjoy this episode.
I'm Mindy Jane Roseman, an associate editor at Sexual and Reproductive Health Matters, and I'm also your moderator. I direct international law programs and the Gruber Program for Global Justice and Women's Rights at Yale Law School, which is in the United States. My background is working on the development of international human rights standards and frameworks surrounding the provision and access to sexual and reproductive health services, including abortion, for over two decades. Over that time period, human rights norms and standards on abortion access have increasingly become more liberal. They address decriminalization, and they require states to ensure that whenever a person's health or life is at issue, that abortion be legal, available, and safe. More and more of the world's nations' laws and practices reflect these standards. And then we have the United States and Texas at the vanguard of what is really a countercurrent against this global normative development towards liberalization of abortion access. So to explain Texas, if that is possible in the time allotted, its abortion ban, its effects, and more, we have with us three people who have direct experience. First up is Dr. Carrie White. She's an associate professor at the Steve Hicks School of Social Work and a faculty research associate at the Population Research Center at the University of Texas in Austin, Texas. Her training is in sociology with a specialization in demography, and she teaches on topics of reproductive health policy, family planning, and immigrant health. Her mixed methods research is wide-ranging. It focuses on family planning services provided at publicly funded clinics in the U.S. and elsewhere, access to abortion, and to vasectomy. Her work has been cited in various friend of the court briefs that have been submitted to support U.S. constitutional abortion rights litigation. And Dr. White will give us a big picture of Texas in terms of what's been going on with attempts to restrict abortion and other sexual and reproductive health services information from sociological, political, whatever perspective she would like to bring to bear. So that is Dr. White. Next up after her is Melanie Fontes, who's a recent Harvard Law graduate, and she is a litigation fellow at the Center for Reproductive Rights. The center is, as you probably all know, a global organization which is at the forefront of protecting, defending, and promoting reproductive rights, both within the United States and outside. She's part of the litigation team that's challenging Texas's SB 8 in the U.S. courts. And she's going to talk about what the state of the law is, the state of the litigation in various state and U.S. courts, and especially its posture before the Supreme Court, and talk a little bit about the other cases that are pending before the Supreme Court. And last, but far from least, is Dr. Samuel Dickman, who is a medical doctor and internist and a health policy researcher. He's the medical director for primary care at Planned Parenthood, South Texas, where he's worked since 2019. And he's a member of the Lancet Commission on Public Policy and Health in the Trump era. May it be behind us. His research over the past decade has focused on health policy and inequality in the healthcare system. And this past February, he published an op-ed in the New York Times. They say they are attacking abortion. They are really hurting the poor. It's still true, only more so. He will tell us about what SB 8 has done to access to abortion services in Texas, perhaps nearby states, as well as access to other sexual and reproductive health services and information, as well as what it's like to provide services at this moment in Texas. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Dr. White.
Great. Thank you, Mindy. So I'm going to provide a little bit of background about what has been happening in Texas and how we got to a law like SB 8. and, you know, kind of how that's situated in other reproductive health policies that have been implemented in the state. So SB 8, although it is extreme in its nature, is not out of step with many things that Texas legislatures have been putting forward for the last decade or so. This is, you know, kind of at the height of a long strategy to try to make abortion services difficult or impossible to access in the state. And what started really picking up speed in Texas was in 2011, following the midterm elections, Texas, as well as many other states in the U.S., saw their state legislatures either have Republican majorities or supermajorities in conjunction with conservative state executive power in the governor's office that allowed them to really start pushing forward with a concerted effort, multiple restrictions on abortion. So in Texas, 10 years ago, the first kind of bill along this line was certainly not the first restriction around abortion in Texas, but really the beginning of this swifter march to curtail access was mandatory ultrasounds requirements that the state legislature passed, requiring patients who already needed to, and providers who already needed to comply with a 24-hour waiting period after receipt of state-mandated misinformation about abortion, to also have an ultrasound performed by the same physician who would also provide their abortion. And that physician had to describe what they viewed on the ultrasound. This, in essence, mandated a person to make 2 in-person visits to the clinic in order to obtain their abortion, and also is intended to try to dissuade people seeking abortion care from continuing with their abortion decision. So that law went into effect really in 2012, and it was also passed during the same legislative session in 2011, in which the legislature, in an effort to exclude Planned Parenthood from publicly funded family planning programs because they are a large provider of abortion services in Texas, the state legislature cut the family planning budget by 2/3 and tiered the remaining funding that was left in the family planning program in such a way that primary health care providers, public health department clinics received preferential funding, and specialized family planning providers, including but certainly not limited to Planned Parenthood, were in the lowest tier for receiving funding, even though these were the providers that were largely doing the majority of family planning services in Texas. So what we started to see at that time was really the dismantling of the reproductive health care safety net with respect to contraceptive services. There were numerous clinics that closed, over 80 by our count, that closed or stopped providing family planning services. With the limited funding that remained available, clinics were not able to offer weekend hours or later hours that were more convenient for teens to try to get contraception. They had more limited availability of some of the more expensive contraceptive devices like IUDs and implants that many people are interested in using. But clinicians were put in a position where they needed to really limit how many of these methods they provided. They maybe had 5 that they could offer in a month, and they had to make decisions about who might get those 5 IUDs this month because there just wasn't enough funding to provide those methods to everybody who wanted them. So that's a little bit of the context before more expansive measures to curtail abortion access, which followed in the subsequent legislative session in 2013, when Texas passed House Bill 2 or HB 2, which was an omnibus abortion restriction bill that had 4 main provisions. One required physicians providing abortion care to have hospital admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles where they practiced. One required facilities to meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers or mini hospitals, even if they just provided medication abortion. There were also restrictions on how medication abortion could be provided by limiting the gestational age limit, requiring providers to follow an outdated protocol. And then there was also limiting the gestational age limit in Texas to 22 weeks of pregnancy as well. So those were the four main provisions of that law. Three of them went into effect, and perhaps the most consequential of those was the admitting privileges requirement. It was very difficult for providers to obtain admitting privileges at hospitals in their community simply because they provided abortion care, and hospitals did not want to offer privileges, or because the providers simply did not admit enough cases to maintain privileges at the hospital because abortion is so safe. And so what we saw is that because providers were not able to obtain privileges, the number of physicians providing care in Texas decreased. This resulted in many clinics in the state closing because they didn't have many physicians providing care at those locations anyway. And these were primarily facilities in smaller communities. In small communities in central Texas, in the Texas Panhandle, in West Texas. So what we ended up with was a situation where people were living, in some cases, hundreds of miles from the nearest facility that was providing abortion care because these smaller facilities had closed. And this consequentially meant that there was a huge demand for services at the remaining facilities, which resulted in long wait times for appointments. I'll just wrap that up there and say that, you know, ultimately this bill was challenged at the Supreme Court and the abortion provider plaintiffs prevailed. And those restrictions, many of those restrictions, with the exception of the gestational age limit, were rescinded. However, there was permanent damage to the network of abortion providers in Texas. Texas still now has only about half of the number of facilities providing abortion that it did before HB2 was passed. And those facilities are still primarily concentrated in five metropolitan areas of the state. And so the entirety of West Texas largely remains without an abortion provider. And so folks there need to travel hundreds of miles to New Mexico, for example, in order to get an abortion. That law was passed in 2013. The Texas legislature meets every 2 years. And at every single legislative session since then, we have seen restriction after restriction put forward and many times passed and implemented since that time. There have been restrictions on how minors can obtain a judicial bypass procedure, bans on the use of telemedicine for medication abortion, requirements that providers bury fetal remains following an abortion, restrictions on the types of procedures that can be used during second trimester abortion. Every single legislative session, there has been a new restriction that has been passed. So even before SB 8 was put forward and implemented, it was hard to get an abortion in Texas. So SB 8 is really just the outgrowth of this long path towards restricting abortion in Texas. And I think so many other bans that, at least on their face, have restricted abortion before viability around 6 weeks. We have seen these types of things pop up in many other states. And those laws have always been found unconstitutional because they limit abortion before viability, which is about 24 weeks or so. But the Texas law is unique, and I'll turn that over to Melanie to describe in a minute. But I think there was some initial thought that there was no way this law was going to go into effect. It was just so blatantly unconstitutional. It wasn't even going to stand. And what we found ourselves in a position in the summer of 2021 is that we were really looking towards a situation where abortion was going to be severely curtailed in the state. And indeed, that's where we have found ourselves. So I think I'll maybe wrap up there and turn it over to Melanie, unless there are any clarifying questions I can answer.
I think that's a great transition over to Melanie. I just want us all to think about, between the time the law was passed in May and it went into effect in September, what were advocates and practitioners, were there plans and preparations should it go into effect? Did it all, certainly, I think it was a shock that it was not immediately struck down upon it reaching the Supreme Court. Melanie, I know you're going to talk about that, but just what happened? Over to Melanie.
Thank you for that. And Dr. Wright, thank you for setting the context for what's happening in Texas. So I want to start by zooming out first and talking a little bit about the context that even Texas is in right now. 2021 is on track to become the most devastating year for abortion restrictions. Since 1973, we've seen thousands of abortion restrictions passed. And just this year alone, we've seen over 100. So what's happening in Texas is certainly not unique. States are banding together to find ways to chip away at access to the right and to severely curtail access for pregnant people across the country. Now, as Dr. Wright said, again, Texas's strategy is not unique. What they are calling a heartbeat ban, which is actually a six-week abortion ban, that is a ban on abortion before most pregnant people even know they are pregnant and over 4 months before viability. That ban has been passed in 17 states across the country. Now, what is unique is that Texas is the only state whose law is currently in effect. And that's because Texas attempted an end run around the Constitution. Typically, when you look at these six-week abortion bans, they are bans on abortion that begin at 6 weeks that are enforced against physicians, but by the state, that is the state AG's office, state prosecutor's offices, local prosecutor's offices, the Department of Health. Texas did something a little bit different. Instead of allowing the state to enforce the six-week ban, it authorizes bounty hunters to sue abortion providers, as well as those who aid and abet anyone who is seeking an abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Now, anyone can come bring suit against the abortion provider or the aider and abettor for providing an abortion above 6 weeks of pregnancy. And what they get in advance is a bounty. They get a minimum of $10,000 per abortion. They are reimbursed for all of their costs and attorney's fees. And of course, the abortion provider or the aider and abettor who has been sued will be automatically enjoined, that is, automatically stopped from providing any further abortion care or support. Now, right now, we have several legal challenges to the law. For those of you who have been following in the news, I know it gets a bit confusing because there are so many cases. I'm going to try to break them down here. I know that the facts and procedure in these cases can be a bit challenging, and that's because the law is a different law than we've ever seen. As I said, we do not typically see states outsourcing their law enforcement, outsourcing their constitutional deprivation of rights, and that's exactly what we have here. So to begin with the center's case, I'll talk about Whole Woman's Health versus Jackson. Now, this is a case that has been brought jointly by the center as well as Planned Parenthood, the Lawyering Project, the ACLU, as a large coalition of abortion clinics, physicians, clinic staff, funds, support networks, and even clergy. Now, the law passed Texas and was signed into law on May 19th. We brought our challenge on July 13th, well before the effective date of September 1st for the law. Typically, in these cases, we would sue the state. We would sue the state of Texas for depriving pregnant people of their right to an abortion. But here, because the law is to be enforced by bounty hunters, we have to think a little differently. And so we sued an anti-abortion activist who had threatened to sue our clients. We sued a class of all state court judges and the state court clerks who would be responsible for docketing the cases, issuing summonses to our clients, and of course, hearing, issuing injunctions, and awarding damages. Finally, we also sued a slew of state agencies, as well as the Texas Attorney General, for a few other provisions in the law, which would chill the ability of physicians to keep providing, and would also chill the ability of any abortion advocate to actually challenge this and future abortion restrictions in the state. Now, the defendants in that case, as is typical, filed what's called a motion to dismiss the case, saying that we had sued the wrong people, that they are immune from suit, and that the case should just be thrown out of court. The district court ruled for us, denied that motion to dismiss, and allowed the proceedings to continue. Now, the state appealed that decision to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, that is the court that sits above Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi. And the Fifth Circuit canceled what would have been a hearing to enjoin, that is, block enforcement of the law before September 1st. And we moved quickly. We asked the Supreme Court to either enjoin the law or to allow the district court to hear our motion for the preliminary injunction. And as you all know, on midnight on September 1st, the law took effect without any word from the Supreme Court. This was devastating. And I know Dr. Dickman will talk more about the effect in the days leading up to September 1st and the days after. But that was really devastating for us. And around 24 hours later, just before midnight on September 1st, the Supreme Court belatedly issued a 5-4 decision refusing to intervene in the case. They let the law stand. They let the law go into effect. This was a devastating opinion for many reasons. One, it was a paragraph-long decision allowing a blatantly unconstitutional law, a law that would deprive millions of pregnant people their rights, to go into effect. The current status of this case is a little confusing and will make more sense as I continue talking today. But we have two pending components of this case. First, we have an appeal still before the Fifth Circuit. Argument has been set for the week of December 6th. Briefing is currently taking place. And essentially, we are appealing the issue of whether the district court is with jurisdiction, that is, whether the district court is allowed to hear the case at all. We also have sitting before the Supreme Court a cert petition before judgment. What this would mean is that the Supreme Court would hear the case before the district court and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals issued their orders. We filed this petition several weeks ago, and we've had some movement since. Again, I will talk a little bit more about those recent developments in a bit. The second set of cases I want to talk about are state court cases. And all of these have been filed against a group, an anti-abortion advocacy group called Texas Right to Life. Now, many of you probably remember hearing about Texas Right to Life. They are the group that created a pro-life whistleblower website to collect tips and issue threats to our clients. Now, this was a site that was blown up over TikTok and Twitter, and because of the help of our allies, the tip site was taken down. But since then, we have had 15 cases filed against Texas Right to Life on the basis of this website. Now, in each of those about 15 cases, we secured a temporary restraining order, which would prevent Texas Right to Life and anyone conspiring with Texas Right to Life from suing the plaintiffs in those suits. Now, this is a very limited form of relief. If you'll remember, SB 8 allows anyone in the world to sue any abortion provider and to sue anyone who aids or abets an abortion provider in providing an abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. So this is a small subset of the potential plaintiffs in any SB 8 suit. Now, although all of those cases were able to achieve that TRO, all those cases were stayed. They were stopped indefinitely by a conservative panel of state court judges. Planned Parenthood, which was one of the plaintiffs bringing suit against Texas Right to Life in state court, quickly filed an emergency request to lift the stay in the Texas Supreme Court. That stay request was denied. And since all 15 of those cases have been transferred to Travis County, but will be heard by a conservative judge from San Antonio. Third case I want to talk to you about is, of course, United States versus Texas. This is the one that's been gaining traction in the news lately. So you've probably heard quite a few developments in the case recently. Here we had DOJ file a federal case against the state of Texas on September 9th. Now, this is 9 days after September 1st, after the law had taken effect. 8 days after the Supreme Court had denied our initial request for an injunction in our first federal case. Now, the case was requesting similar relief as our Home Women's Health versus Jackson case, but had fewer procedural hurdles. And that's because it's the United States suing. The United States simply does not have the same hurdles to overcome that a private plaintiff would. Now, the same judge was assigned to hear the case, and that judge held a preliminary injunction hearing on October 1st. At that hearing, he would determine whether the law should remain in effect or whether the law should be blocked pending further court review. And the judge there decided to enjoin enforcement of the law on October 6th. That injunction prevented judges and court clerks in Texas from accepting any lawsuits sanctioned by the ban and required that the state publish a copy of the injunction on its public-facing court. That same night that the injunction was issued, though, the state of Texas filed a notice of appeal with the Fifth Circuit, just letting them know that they were going to request relief from that injunction to get the law back into effect. And on October 8th, the state also filed emergency motions with the Fifth Circuit to completely block that injunction, that is, to let the law go back into effect immediately to speed up the proceedings. Now, in the meantime, during those 2 days, some abortion providers resumed care. And that's something you've definitely seen covered by the media. And this is despite fear of retroactivity provision in SB 8. One other foul feature of SB 8, of course, is that anyone who provides while the law is blocked, if the law ultimately is upheld in the courts, can be sued for any provision of care while the law was blocked for up to 4 years after that care was provided. That ruinous liability continues even if a court has said the law is unconstitutional. Now, on October 8th, the same day that Texas requested emergency relief, the Fifth Circuit granted what's called an administrative stay. That means they were just blocking it, the injunction, that is, letting the law go back into effect while they reviewed the papers. And as expected, on October 14th, the Fifth Circuit completely stayed the injunction. That is, the law was completely back in effect and would be until a formal appeal. On October 18th, the Department of Justice filed an application for the Supreme Court to get rid of that stay, that is, to let the law be blocked, and also for cert before judgment, if you'll recall, the exact relief that we had requested before the Supreme Court. Currently, Texas and the other defendants must respond to both of the cert petitions, that is, the cert petition in the Department of Justice case, as well as the cert petition in the case brought by the abortion clinics, providers, and funds, by tomorrow at noon. And finally, just to leave a little bit of confusion for you, the center has filed an additional case, Braid versus Stille. Now, many of you might remember that on September 18th, in the Washington Post, our client, Dr. Alan Braid, published an op-ed saying he had provided one abortion on September 6th in violation of SB 8. Dr. Braid is, of course, someone who's probably very familiar to Drs. White and Dickman. He has been an abortion provider since 1972. He has seen every flavor of unconstitutional abortion ban and restriction that Texas has passed. What he did was brave, and he invited lawsuits against him. So far, three claimants have sued him in Texas state court, one from Bel Air, Texas, and two from out-of-state disbarred attorneys in Illinois and Arkansas. On October 5th, we filed a new lawsuit in federal court in Illinois. This is a somewhat unusual move, but necessary for us to get a declaration that SB 8 is unconstitutional. This lawsuit also requested that those three cases against Dr. Braid be consolidated because they were asking for the same thing against the same abortion provision. And one defendant so far has responded, filing a motion to dismiss the action, throwing the action out of court. Those are the major federal cases and state cases against SB 8. I would be remiss to talk about SB 8 and the litigation against SB 8 without also talking about the pending Supreme Court case, that is Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Now, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization is a case challenging Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. It's a direct challenge to the central holding of Roe. That is, the state is actually challenging Roe v. Wade explicitly. It's worth explaining a little bit how we got to this place. Perhaps not as extensive a history as Dr. White provided, but just want to give you a little bit about the litigation history. Now, of course, Jackson Women's Health, what's at stake? 50 years of precedent. Everything the Supreme Court has said about abortion and the right to abortion since Roe v. Wade. And we anticipate that this will have an effect on rights beyond abortion, about our intimate relationships, about marriage, about contraception. This is just the start. So what happened in the case? Now, this case, at least at the Supreme Court, dates back to 2020. And in June 2020, Mississippi asked the Supreme Court to take this case. Now, for any attorneys on the line, you'll recall that the Supreme Court kept pushing off its consideration of whether it would consider the case. And on May 17th, it decided to hear the case. It's difficult to say that anything other than the composition of the court changing, that is, the addition of new justices on the court, impacted that decision. And that's because of what the lower court said, all of which found the law uniformly unconstitutional. The Southern District of Mississippi, that is the district court that initially heard the case, talked about the law as part of a decades-long campaign fueled by national interest groups to get the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Fifth Circuit, that is the appeals court that we had also talked about in SB 8, talked about an unbroken line of precedent dating from Roe v. Wade in 1973 to the present, that have affirmed and reaffirmed a woman's right to choose an abortion before viability. And just as an aside, although the court often talks about a woman's right to choose, of course, we are here to defend the right of any person who is pregnant, who may become pregnant, to choose an abortion before viability. And yet again, just 3 years ago, the Southern District of Mississippi, that is the district court, talked about this professed interest that Mississippi and other states have talked about in women's health as pure gaslighting. What's happening here is not a ploy to protect women, to protect pregnant people, but rather a clear disdain for the health and well-being of pregnant people in their communities. Now, up until the state of Mississippi filed its brief with the Supreme Court this past October, we weren't really getting the explicit, this is about Roe v. Wade. This is about overturning Roe v. Wade. But that's exactly where we are now. The state of Mississippi, the states who have filed friend of the court briefs, the advocates who have filed friends of the court's briefs are clear. They are seeking to overturn Roe v. Wade. They're calling the decision egregiously wrong, proven hopelessly unworkable, inflicted significant damage. And what's at stake for us in the context of Mississippi? Jackson Women's Health is the only remaining abortion clinic. This is in a state that has the highest percentage of Black people of any state in the country. And of course, as we know, the majority of people obtaining abortion care in the state are Black. Mississippi is ranked last in the U.S. for the health of pregnant people and children. Again, laying any possible message that Mississippi has that this is about protecting the health of pregnant people and children. As a final parting gift for you all, I would urge you to visit the center's website, What If Roe Fell? You can just Google that and you'll be directed to the link. And you can see what is at stake. Now, of course, the most severe is exactly what I have on the screen here. The states that have trigger bans, that is the states that will automatically outlaw abortion the second the Supreme Court overrules Roe v. Wade. That's 17 states. A slew of other states have 6-week bans, similar to Texas, and again, slightly easier for them to enforce without the bounty hunter provision that we are seeing in Texas. Yet other states have total bans on abortions that perhaps are not triggered by Roe v. Wade, but will be difficult to challenge in court if Roe v. Wade is overturned. What's next for us? I do want to turn your attention just briefly to some legislation that the center is very excited about and that hopefully you all have been hearing about as well. And that's a federal solution to reproductive health care access, the Women's Health Protection Act. Now, this would safeguard the right to abortion, safeguard us against bans and medically unnecessary restrictions. And this is a bill that has passed the House already on September 24th by an overwhelming 218 to 211 vote. We're excited to see this legislation continue to pass through Congress, and I welcome any questions on either the litigation or on the Women's Health Protection Act.
Melanie, thank you. You are a rock star for getting us through all that material in such a lucid and compelling way. Thank you so much. What I'd like to do right now is turn it over to Dr. Dickman. And also, if just by way of background, Dr. Dickman, you could explain a little bit about how one pays for access to reproductive health care in the United States, the particularities of restrictions on federal and some state funds to support access to health care for those who are lower income, as well as the role that Planned Parenthood plays in the provision of health care for people who have constrained resources.
Yeah, thanks, Mindy. Thanks, Melanie. And thanks, Dr. White. That was really interesting and great to get the historical and legal background. I'm an abortion provider in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm going to take a much more concrete view of what's going on for patients that I see in my clinic. My clinical practice is, before SB 8, was kind of 90% abortion care and 10% primary care, including contraceptive and other reproductive health care. That has changed hugely in SB 8. And so I just want to emphasize that the ban under SB 8 that says that abortion is not legal after fetal cardiac activity is detected, it just bears repeating. It's extremely restrictive. And that's because, you know, 6 weeks is not 6 weeks. So 6 weeks is definitely basically 2 weeks, because it's 2 weeks since you miss your period. So the first 2 weeks are literally don't exist because those are the weeks before you even had sex. And then you have 2 more weeks before you even miss your period. And then you have about 2 weeks, which is really, really, really small. And the way I think about it is more like 1 week, because an ultrasound doesn't detect a pregnancy until about 5 weeks, the way we measure it. And then by 5 weeks and 6 days, certainly 6 weeks, cardiac activity is detectable. So it is extremely limiting. That's why people are having to travel out of state or just not get abortions. And so, you know, because when I think about doing something in the next 6 weeks, that seems doable, but this is not that. You know, Mindy, you asked about how people pay for abortions, and actually Melanie alluded to this too, about when people kind of find out they're pregnant and how quickly they're able to make a decision about getting an abortion, and then how quickly they're able to actually get an abortion. I would say that a huge number of my patients come in 8 weeks, 9 weeks. They're like, yeah, like my periods are just a little bit kind of off always. And then I took a pregnancy test. I found out yesterday that I'm pregnant, and I do an ultrasound and they're 9 weeks pregnant. So that is a large number of patients. Someone like that at this point in Texas, I'm telling them you need to drive 17 hours minimum to get to New Mexico. But actually, most people know they're pregnant before 6 weeks. The average amount of time is, you know, 5.5 weeks-ish when people find out they're pregnant. And that's not to say that there aren't tons of people who find out later, but it's not just find out you're pregnant and get an abortion like that, especially in Texas, right? So there are obviously a ton of reasons why someone might need a few days, even a few weeks to decide to have an abortion. For many people, though not everybody, it's a big decision. But then there are the logistics, like Dr. White was saying, right? Like a lot of my patients travel hundreds of miles. I was just on the website, countries that fit inside Texas. There are a lot of countries that would fit inside Texas. Texas, it cannot be overemphasized. It's enormous. It's bigger than France and Germany and Afghanistan. It's huge. And so the thought of getting from West Texas, from South Texas up to San Antonio is, you know, that's not something that you can just pick up, especially for people who have childcare responsibilities, who have jobs that they can't just take a day off spur of the moment. And then Mindy asked about financing, and this is a huge issue in Texas. So, you know, the cost of an abortion ends up being between $500 and $800 for a first trimester abortion in Texas, which is a huge amount of money. Now, you might think, well, insurance should pay for that. And that just doesn't happen in Texas, except for a tiny, tiny, very privileged slice of our patients. The vast majority of patients are uninsured. Texas has the highest rate of uninsurance in the nation, or they have insurance, but it doesn't cover abortion. And that's because some of the, you know, 1,100 restrictions that Melanie was alluding to say that you can't cover abortion if you're an insurance company in Texas, not only for the public insurance, which is called Medicaid, but also for private insurance. If you're privately insured in Texas, you can't get coverage for abortion. And so that means patients are having to ask friends and family, dig into their savings for $700. And we know that in Texas, like in the rest of the country, abortion services are accessed mostly by people who are low or middle income. And so for someone to just have $700 lying around is extremely unlikely. And so even if they know they're pregnant at 5 weeks, it's going to take them much more time to actually get those funds. So what has SB8 been like in Texas? You know, it's honestly been horrible for patients. We every day see patients who are 6, 7 weeks, and I am there to tell them that, you know, I try to like keep a good attitude about it, but I'm there to tell them, like, you have to travel to New Mexico to get a legal abortion. And New Mexico, again, is a 17-hour drive round trip from here. And that's the closest clinic. That clinic only provides medication abortion. If someone needs or wants surgical abortion, they're going to have to get to Albuquerque or fly to Denver or travel to Louisiana, where they would be subjected to even more onerous waiting periods. We talk a lot about inequality in health, just generally in kind of like public health. And sometimes you can only detect it when you run regressions on, you know, millions of observations, and you're like, oh, it turns out that people with low incomes have slightly worse access to care than people with moderate or high incomes. SBA really isn't like that. It is so obvious that patients with low incomes or who face other kinds of marginalization just have vastly worse access to abortion services right now. So I had a patient last week who was planning a trip to California to visit her sister. And for her, I was just like, this is not your favorite vacation plan, but you should get an abortion in California because you can't get it here. And it's going to be a lot easier to get it done there. But of course, the majority of our patients that we see are not traveling to California. Many of them are low income. Many of them work jobs that they can't take time off for 2 or 3 days to travel out of the state. And many of them just hear that abortion is outlawed and that's it. I sit in a room with them, showing them an ultrasound at 6.5 weeks. And those are really, really hard moments with patients. One thing that might be maybe not fully appreciated is that being able to get an abortion privately is really important for a lot of people. So I had a patient just a couple of weeks ago, shortly after SB8 went into effect. She didn't have a car. She lived at home with her parents. She was 19 years old. And when I explained to her that she was 7 weeks pregnant and that she would need to travel out of state to get a legal abortion, she kind of explained that there was no way that was going to happen because she lived with her father, who was anti-abortion. And she said that it was likely that he would become violent if he found out that she had gone out of state. There's no way to drive 17 hours to New Mexico without your family member finding out. And so she, like many, many people, including probably most people who just aren't even coming into clinic anymore, is continuing a pregnancy at this point. Maybe I'll leave it at that. Give it back to you, Mindy.
Well, thank you. It seems a very difficult time to be a practitioner in Texas and to seek services. Do you find that anti-abortion activism is more emboldened? Do you see more of a presence surrounding clinics? Or maybe in tandem, where are you finding some pockets of support, if any?
So here's one thing that has happened a lot in the last month and a half since SB8 went into effect, is that patients will come in and they will start asking questions about self-managed abortion. So getting abortion pills online, which is like a game changer for many, many patients who, if they have the kind of wherewithal and the money in the bank to put, you know, a couple hundred dollars on their credit card, they can get an abortion, but it's not legal. And because of the law, the way the law is written, I'm certainly not allowed, you know, legally to explain that to patients. Now, so they'll ask questions that kind of make me wonder, are you actually interested in getting an abortion? Or are you recording this conversation and trying to get me to say something that could be conceived as aiding and abetting an abortion? It's awful to feel like I am having to be wary of my patients in that way, but I am, you know, and it's a small number of patients. And of course, like, this hasn't actually, you know, my voice hasn't ended up on YouTube by one of these anti-abortion groups, but that's the kind of suspicion and polarization that a law like this really breeds. And so it's more insidious than having someone stand outside the clinic and protest, which also happens a lot and continues to happen under SB8. But there's this whole other kind of flavor to it of a real kind of just unease around who can enforce this law. Now that I've considered like where there's support, you know, I think one thing that's happened is that tons of people around the country and in Texas have been donating to funds to help patients get out of state and pay for abortions. And that is enormously helpful. So I think those kind of funds, so whether it's the Lilith Fund or Fund Texas Choice or Jane's Due Process, these are three funds that really have helped a ton of the patients I've seen and my colleagues have seen in Texas to get out of state.
Melanie, I just wanted to know what, you know, it's not legal advice, but do you think making a donation to a fund is considered aiding and abetting under SB8? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Of course, nothing here is legal advice, but no, we do not consider that aiding and abetting. We urge everyone to donate to their abortion funds, both in Texas and locally. As the doctors have alluded to, pregnant people are traveling out of state right now to receive abortion care. the cost of an abortion, as Dr. Dickman said, is at a minimum $500, can range upwards of above $2,000. And that's just the cost of the procedure itself. That says nothing for the travel costs, the childcare costs, the hotel costs, the food costs associated with those abortion procedures. In states where, as I might note, are not unlike Texas, that may require that the pregnant person visit the clinic more than once to obtain that abortion. So no, you will not be sued for aiding and abetting, but of course, not legal advice here.
I might just mention there has been a lot of international attention on SB 8 from different UN actors, from the Working Group on Discrimination Against Women in Law and Practice, along with some special rapporteurs, have issued statements. It's not as if the international mechanisms necessarily can provide swift relief, but given at least the Biden's administration's posture towards the international human rights system in general, it's certainly more favorable than under the Trump administration. We might at least see more normative support and perhaps some creative use of international mechanisms to ultimately deliver relief to perhaps individuals and providers. But it is the United States, should Roe be overturned, will be a country in which does not provide equal protection of the law and rights to all of its citizens. It will really be quite a patchwork, particularly because there is no, at least not yet, federal legislation that would equalize access to, you know, to critical healthcare issues without discrimination on the basis of race and gender and sexual orientation and so on. The United States is a particularly different kind of legislative and policy and lived experience place than many other nations which have unitary governments, aren't federal system, and don't leave so much discretion to states to determine what constitutional rights their residents enjoy. We might see, for example, in Massachusetts, that Commonwealth providing free abortions for all who need and all who can get there, whereas Alabama would be a different situation. Women's Health Protection Act sounds promising amidst all the despair, but I was wondering whether in the meantime, public health authorities or NGOs are monitoring the statistics of the adverse effects on the ban. Dr. White, have you been following it, Melanie or Planned Parenthood, Dr.
Yeah, I will say that our team at the Texas Policy Evaluation Project is monitoring what has happened in Texas as well as what is happening in other states since SB 8 has gone into effect. So we are looking at likely decreases in the numbers of abortions that have taken place in Texas, as well as increases in Texans traveling out of state for care. We will also be looking at any changes in pregnancy duration at when people are able to obtain care in other states. We are expecting hundreds to probably well over 1,000 Texans traveling to other states to get care. And just from some anecdotal evidence that we are hearing from providers in other states, they are absolutely overwhelmed with Texans seeking care. Oklahoma and New Mexico specifically are just being inundated with Texans needing care. And they are reaching out to states that you would not expect to see if they can see Texas patients. I also do work in Mississippi, and Mississippi has been seeing patients from Texas, this one clinic that is barely providing care to the entire state and is on the precipice of having access severely curtailed, is becoming an overflow because other states are just not able to meet the demands of Texans getting care. So this is really how stark the situation is. And we'll be doing more tracking and reporting on this as the data come in.
I think Dr. White's group at the University of Texas has been really helping us feel like research does have a place in policy work around this, where so often it feels like more research is not needed. What's needed is real political action. I think Dr. White's group at the University of Texas has shown that there's a huge role for research in addition to political action by accurately measuring and reporting the effects of not just SB 8, but a decade of restrictions.
can and should advocates be doing in states that are hostile, discussing, following on, and what Texas is doing? And I would also say, you know, there's a common saying in Latin America, when the United States sneezes, Latin America catches a cold. But I suspect there may be some global knock-on effects. So that's one thing to think about. And secondly, can anyone speak to the science behind the heartbeat part of SB8? This person's understanding is that what's detected via vaginal ultrasound at about 6 weeks is embryonic cardiomyocytes maturing and firing, but that the fetal heart doesn't develop fully for much longer. Is that correct? So this is a media issue, like communications and talking that it's a fetal heartbeat when in fact it's embryonic pulsing. So those two questions, what can be done? And could you give us, maybe Dr. Dickman, some clarity on the science?
I'll jump in and talk a little bit about what can be done. I think this is really the moment to be mad and stay mad. What's happening in Texas, what's happening across the country is egregious. It's not the only state that we're going to see something like SB8 being passed. We're already seeing the same legislation being passed in Arkansas and Florida. So if you are in a hostile to abortion state, you need to be calling your legislators. You need to be talking to reproductive justice advocates on the ground and figuring out exactly where support is needed. And that really applies to any state. Of course, it's most urgent in states like Arkansas and Florida that are contemplating these copycat bills right now. But truly everywhere we're looking at a whirlwind of abortion restrictions. And Wisconsin, I believe, is one of the states that has a pre-Roe abortion ban on the books. Even our friendly states have these bans on the books that we need to look out for. So to the extent that you are able to talk to and connect with reproductive justice advocates, figure out where your help is needed, put your money to abortion funds, call your legislators, be engaged. And listen to patient stories. I mean, there was a fantastic podcast put out by The Daily earlier in September where they were able to speak with patients just to get a sense of what exactly patients are experiencing on the ground. Educate yourselves to figure out exactly where you can fit into this picture.
And without going into embryology, I'll say that the question is right. There's no discernible heart or heartbeat at 6 weeks or even 8 weeks. And that's important to note and to appreciate that the messaging really matters, and to use the term heartbeat is very evocative. But of course, like, legislatures can do whatever they want and they're not constrained by medical science, right? So if they want to call it a heartbeat, they can call it a heartbeat, and that has the force of law until it's deemed unconstitutional in the courts. So nothing I or any embryologist say about the technical definitions will change the impact of the law, unfortunately.
So there's a question about the role that international bodies could play and have played in the past on other issues. For example, there's a famous U.S. Supreme Court case that denied relief to a person, a woman whose family was killed by the police in contravalence of an order of protection that that city had issued. And the Supreme Court said she had no constitutional right to protection from the police, which I'm exaggerating for it to simplify. But eventually she was able to at least get a fair hearing before the Inter-American Commission. And so the international space can in some ways deliver a certain kind of justice to individuals and a forum for understanding different claims that the United States Constitution and its very formal approach to rights can deliver to people. The arc of justice is very long. The United States is part of a community of nations, and the more over time it gets integrated into an international system. The United States was one of the founders of the modern human rights system. It has been an ambivalent supporter of it. It sometimes takes note of what these bodies say about its behavior and sometimes not. But I do think over time, it will become more and more embedded, particularly as the composition, the demography of the United States evolves and becomes more international. And we become a more tightly knit global community. We just have to keep watching and working in that space. It's not a quick fix to anything that happens within the US. Thank you so much, Dr. White, Dr. Dickman, and Melanie, for your work and for your expertise and for the time you took in sharing it with us. And until the next.